Hello and welcome to North. This is a new podcast. I'm not the host of it, but I'm here with the host of it, and he's asked me to host the first one. My name is Stefano Nolan, or Stevie Nolan, if you have a problem with that first name. I'm the host of another podcast on this podcast platform, and that's Workers' Guide to Everything by Trademark Belfast. And I'm here with Steve Baker, good comrade of ours, good mate of ours, a native of Belfast, a former shop steward for the Transport and General Workers Union, now an activist within the UCU, the University and Colleges Union. Spends a bit of time talking to students and lecturing, also spends quite a lot of time on picket lines. Steve, you're very welcome to your own podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And we're here today to talk about, your new podcast that you're going to host. And I know that Steve was talking about the absence of a nuanced debate and the absence of different kinds of voices in debates around, a very current debate around the relationships between the people on this island, but also between this island and our little one next door, which we don't call the mainland on this podcast, just to set some fucking rules down before we start. And I was talking to Steve about how we needed to make sure that the nuance of the debate needs to be introduced, and then we start listening to different voices, and particularly voices from the Protestant community as well. And Steve wants to talk about that. So for the first podcast, I'm going to be sort of interviewing him, but from this point on, it's going to be his baby, and he'll take it forward. So Steve, look, first question, I suppose, is where did the idea come from, and what is the idea? What do you want to get out of it? Give me a bit of background to that, mate.
Well, I can't really take any credit for the idea of the podcast. I mean, in many respects, that was your idea.
But there can never be enough podcasts.
There can't be. But I mean, the idea for it came from yourselves, but it coincided with my own thinking, because one of the things that I'd become concerned about was that there was a kind of debate taking place here about the future constitutional position of this place, Northern Ireland to the north, about what that future was going to look like. And it seemed to be that the debate had got no further than how we moved one group of people from one jurisdiction into another. And I didn't think that was a terribly useful place to start from. So I kind of sat down. I thought, first of all, I would get a few friends together and we might do that typically academic thing, which is put together an edited collection that nobody would read. But I sort of thought, let's put together an edited collection. And I thought, invite people to write some essays and just see if we can get some fresh and new perspectives on this. I said that had been rolling around for ages. It hadn't got a great deal of traction. So when you came along and sort of said, why don't you do a podcast on this? I sort of thought, well, this is exactly where to start with this, So, I mean, this I envisage that this will maybe sort of start as a podcast, but mm-hmm. Who knows what else might come from it. I mean, podcasts, as you sort of say, there's so many of them. But, if something good comes out of it, be interesting maybe to sort of get something into print at some stage that, you can begin to pass to people and get them to read and think about.
Was there anything in particular that provoked your kind of interest in the idea that you needed to get different voices to be heard on this subject, rather than the very much the narrative that's laid down by the establishment? Yeah. About these are the kind of Protestants we want, so we're going to only talk to these people, this is the only view we want to hear, these are the kind of Republicans and Catholics we want to hear from, so they're the only voices we're going to hear, and you get a very truncated and clipped and a non-nuanced view of who lives here and what their views are.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you a story. I got a phone call maybe about a year and a half ago from the BBC. Now, the BBC very rarely call me these days, so I was quite flattered that they paid any attention to me. And they said they were doing a radio documentary about the sort of state of the union. And they wanted to talk to people who were, unionists. And they wanted to talk to people who were loyalists, people who would be difficult to move constitutionally. But they also wanted to talk to people who they referred to as persuadables.
Sounds like a really shit B movie.
It does, doesn't it? And I apparently was one of the persuadables. No, the producer was a lovely guy, but I just turned around and I said to him, look, I don't want to be a persuadable. I don't regard myself as a persuadable. Persuadable makes me sound like I'm sort of like, I've no politics of my own. And like I'm just sort of somebody standing in a sweet shop trying to make a selection between mint imperials and cinnamon lozenges. I said, I want to be part of this debate. I want to be persuading people. I've got a politics and a point of view, and I want to be persuading people also. And, I said, I don't think I'm the only person that kind of feels like that. So he spoke to me for about an hour on the phone and took a lot of notes. And he says, this sounds great. He said, you're exactly what we're looking for. And so the BBC, being as thorough as the BBC are, they said to me, where would you like to go and be interviewed? And I said, well, I don't mind. He says, we want to take you somewhere that's meaningful, somewhere that, you know, that you connect with. And the only place I could think of was Ballywalter Beach. We take a dog for a walk there occasionally. But I sort of said, look, Ballywalter Beach, because you can, from Ballywalter, you can see Scotland. And if we're talking about constitutional transformation, it might be quite interesting to be somewhere where you can see Scotland. He said, brilliant. This is radio, so whether you, it doesn't matter whether you can see Scotland or not. So they take me to Ballywalter, and they park me on the harbour, and they interviewed me for 2 hours. It was like a two-hour interrogation sitting on these rocks on Ballywalter Harbour. And that, after that, I thought, well, that's not, we'll see what comes of this. The day before the programme was to be broadcast, I got a phone call from the producer, and he sort of says, look, he says, I'm really sorry, Stevie. He says, I really don't know how to tell you this, but you and your mates have all been cut from this programme. And I said, don't worry about it. He says, look, you're taking this very well. He says, I've got to offer you an explanation. And I said, look, don't worry about it. I said, look, I write stuff all the time. I know that sometimes when you're constructing a particular type of narrative, things just end up in the cutting room floor. He says, that's exactly it. He says, I'm so glad you're understanding. He says, we just couldn't get you to fit the narrative. And there was other people as well, he mentions, he says, who didn't take it so well. He said, you know, they didn't fit the narrative either. And so, you know, that in some respects is what I'd like to see this podcast do, which is to recover those voices that usually end up in the cutting room floor because they just don't fit a particular narrative. So that would be a kind of starting point for it, you know.
And that's not a bad starting point. I still think The Persuadables is a great name for something, for a band, maybe. Maybe for your next band you could say, yeah, The Persuadables. But in terms of the title North, I'm going to ask you about that. I do remember, and I kind of have an idea of where it came from. I remember listening to you in one of our political schools down in the island of Lusty Beg, the Bates Sinclair Winter School, and you gave this really interesting talk to basically a group of Republicans and former and ex-prisoners, and it was about what you thought of Northern Ireland, the six counties, you know, the North, whatever you want to call it. And they were so shocked to hear you say that. I think the phrase you used was, I don't think this place exists, or this place doesn't exist for me, or this place is, what is this place? And so tell me about that. Tell me about why you've chosen the title North, because I think it says an awful lot, and I think it opens up an awful lot of space for debate about what this place is and what its relationship is to the South, I suppose.
Yeah, it's one of the things that I'd been thinking about for a long time. I mean, that occasion down in Lusty Beg, I remember it really well. It was really interesting because, you know, I was sort of standing eavesdropping on a, as you said, group of Republicans who were sitting discussing, talking about politics. And at this stage, we'd all had a couple of drinks, and I had a bit more sort of courage in me, and I sort of turned around and I said to them, do you still aspire to a United Ireland? And they sort of said, yeah, we do. We don't want to kill anybody for it, but we do. We would aspire to that. And I said, well, look, you understand that if that ever happens, it's not like you're just going to swallow the North. I said, it's going to be a new country. It's going to be a new state. And they all looked at each other and went, yeah, we're fine with that. The one we're in at the moment's pretty crap, you know. And it was that kind of recognition that both of us were in the same situation. You know, these kind of failing states are states that were failing us. And so, you know, I kind of, that got me thinking, and these things always take a long time, don't they, to sort of come to any kind of fruition. But that got me sort of thinking, but got me thinking about the place I live in, the North. And it got me thinking about a quote from a Welsh historian, the late Gwyn Alf Williams, who'd written a book called When Was Wales? And there's this quote in it that I just keep coming back to. He says that Wales is an artefact. Wales is an artefact. What a really strange way, mm-hmm. interesting way to talk about a country or a place. He says, Wales is an artefact which the Welsh produce if they want to. It requires an act of choice. And that led me to sort of think, well, you know, if making a place, if producing a place is an act of choice, who actually has chosen to produce a place called Northern Ireland? Because it seemed to me, on the one hand, you know, understandably, Irish nationalists aren't invested in producing this place, or Irish Republicans aren't invested in producing a place called Northern Ireland. And when you look at unionism and loyalism, they've kind of singularly failed to produce it, you know, and to make this place kind of function. And you can look at it at the moment. If we want to talk about Northern Ireland as an artifact that the people in Northern Ireland produce, at the moment, we've got a dysfunctional government. Mm-hmm. You know, we have, you know, there's, you know, we still have extraordinary rates of poverty. You know, some of the poorest wards at the start of the Troubles are still the poorest wards now. We have a mental health epidemic which isn't being addressed. Tremendous trauma and fallout from the Troubles themselves, and more peace lines and more division. So, you know, that's another thing I think it would be interesting to talk to people about is, you know, what is this place where we're trying to produce? You know, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to call it North.
Or what is this place we're trying to deconstruct and reconstruct something new? That's also another. You talked about the lack of investment from Irish Republicans in this place because it's not theirs. It doesn't feel like it's theirs. But then, you know, what does that mean for the future of the place? If there's going to be a, can this place be renewed or are its days numbered? I know that's the theme you're going to address with the other people you have on as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's this sort of thing that if it is, the interesting thing about the Williams quote is that if you begin to think of a place as an artifact which is produced by the people who live there, then that begins, you become agents. You there's an anticipation that the people who live here will have a voice and a say over what is actually produced. And I'm not too sure that they have a voice. And certainly the persuadables, you know, who don't fit the narrative end up in the cutting room floor, so they have no voice at all. But it might be quite interesting to hear from them, you know, because maybe what this place needs is precisely some fresh perspectives on it that we're not hearing at the moment. Because it's very, very clear that the narratives that we have just have kind of run into the ground.
It's interesting you talk about agency, because you could argue historically, did anyone in the so-called union have any agency in the creation of that union? Because they're subjects, they're not citizens. There's never really been a, as you said before, a revolution or a bourgeois revolution in England or in Britain as such. So it's not a creation of the people, it's a creation of the state, of the capitalist class. I mean, it's a state that doesn't represent the people. So, and this adjunct to it, the North, you know, it's part of something that was never created through democracy in the first place. It's an imposition on people. And one of my hopes for the future, and I know yours too, is that people do get a chance to create the space and become active agents in the creation of a new society.
I mean, look, I mean, it's interesting, you know, I'm precisely the type of guy who really at one stage wanted to avoid thinking about questions about where we live and its constitution and the kind of political framework within which we live. Because I'm much more comfortable talking about social and economic questions and environmental ones. Those are the ones that I want to talk about. But it's become increasingly apparent to me as I've got older that actually if you don't have a constitutional settlement which allows you to address those social, economic and environmental concerns, then you will never get to them. So actually the constitution itself is kind of vital. It's kind of really important. And it's like a kind of progression in my own sort of thinking. You're never the finished product, but it's a kind of progression of thinking. I remember after the last election that delivered the Johnson government, you and I turned up in here and Mel was here. Mm-hmm. And the two of us came in, we were miserable looking. And Mel met us and he says, what the fuck's wrong with you? He's in the very direct way. He says, what the fuck's wrong with you too? And I said, Jesus, Mel, just look at the election result. It's awful. You know, we've got Johnson government, you know, it's landslide victory for them. It's terrible. And he turned around and he sort of said, well, what did you sign up for? What's the first line in the Communist Manifesto? The history of all hitherto society is a history of class struggle. If you didn't sign up for struggle, fuck off. And, you know, in a way, he was absolutely right about that, you know. But one of the things that occurred to me at that moment was that, you know, I mean, I'm 55 years old. I know I don't look, I'm in good condition, you know, but I'm 55 years old.
It looks all right.
You know, I have never elected a government. Never. You know, I've lived 55 years old. I've never elected a government. And I see no prospect of me ever electing a government. And I don't think that's good enough. No. It's not good enough for me. It's not good enough for my family, my friends, my neighbours. It's not good enough for my children. So this conversation about the constitutional settlement within which we live has got to take place, because we've got to stop behaving like subjects. We've got to become citizens and we've got to find a voice. And as I say, one of the voices that I think we need to hear from are those people who too often end up on the cutting room floor, but might have something to contribute here, something fresh.
No, absolutely. And for those who don't know, just if there's new listeners to this podcast, Steve was talking about Mel, and I should sense it. That's Mel Corrie, who features heavily on the Trademark podcast. Unfortunately, Mel passed away in January 2021 of COVID. Lifelong trade unionist, activist and communist. And he always used to say to anyone who was down in the mouth, you know, life is struggle, accept that and it gets kind of easier. And I kind of, that's my mantra for living life. And I accept that life is going to be tough and it's a struggle. And that way it becomes more acceptable to face the challenge we do. Look, in terms of that, those cutting room floor voices, then the people who end up on the cutting room floor, who are you going to invite on? What kind of people? You don't have to give me names. I don't know if you've got a big long list of people. What kind of voices do you want to bring onto the podcast and who do you think we should be listening to?
Well, I'm going to try not to be too prescriptive.
Does that mean you haven't got anyone lined up?
It means I've got one person lined up. No, I've got one person lined up. I've got other people in mind and other people just trying to arrange dates and stuff with them. But I mean, in a way, it was. I don't want to be too prescriptive, and that in many ways is an attempt to hold true to the title of the podcast, which is North, mm-hmm. Which is the title I had for the idea of the collection, the other collection I mentioned earlier on. And the idea of calling it North was I'm shamelessly ripping off Seamus Heaney's fourth collection, North, because I think it's really interesting. You know, it's North is a title of it. It's the collection that he writes when he moves south to live in Wicklow, but he's still reflecting upon the political situation in the north. So, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's important, this sort of move to the south, because we want to speak to colleagues and comrades and friends in the south and start a conversation there with them. But the other thing about North, and I can't remember whether it's Heaney said this or whether one of his reviewers said it, North's an interesting title because North could be a place, North could be a direction, mm-hmm. or North could be a state of mind. And I like that kind of openness because it means we're not going to be too prescriptive. And there's no point sort of coming into a podcast and sort of saying, you know, we're awful hurt about the fact that some of us end up on the cutting room floor of the BBC and then being too prescriptive in what we do. We're open to being surprised by people. You know, we're open to the idea that people may come in and say something that we hadn't thought about before. But if it's progressive and it's useful and it's democratic, then this might be exactly the kind of forum to hear that in.
Okay, it reminds me of trying to explain to someone once about what, you know, as a London-born sort of Irishman with Irish family from both sides of the border, would raise a family here and lived here for a long time there, but they're asking what my perception of the North was. And this was a group of loyalist ex-prisoners I was working with and had been working with for a long time. And all these lads I knew, and they're all blokes, they could draw the map of Northern Ireland real detail. They couldn't draw Ireland, but they could draw Northern Ireland as part of that. They had no clue what the rest of the island looked like. And they're asking me what my perception, because I understood their perception of it. And they're asking me what my perception was. And I says, well, look, when I live in County Down, and when I go to visit my mum and dad in Westmeath, we leave County Down, we cross into North Louth, we cut through North Meath into Westmeath. And the only borders that we cross are county borders. That's my perception of this place. It's almost that it doesn't, I know it exists, I know it's here, I know it's constitutionally part of the UK, so-called, but for us as a family, we don't recognise that. We just go through these county board. And the lads couldn't understand that. Like, but this place exists. You know, not to me and my family, it doesn't. I think my eldest daughter didn't even... She came into me one day and was 11, and she said, what's Northern Ireland? Like, she'd never heard the term in our house. Now, I'm not saying I had policed the borders of what was appropriate language in our house, but clearly it had never come up because we didn't use that sort of language. So having that debate about people's perception of this place, I think, is going to be fascinating. But also there's another debate that needs to happen, is that the perceptions of Southerners of the North and the perceptions of Northerners of Southerners, is that going to be part of that debate? Because in the South, there are very strange perceptions of this place. And up until the peace process, and even since, there's an awful lot of people in the South who've literally never been over the border, who have a strange view of this place, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. Maeve McDade was talking about this on the other Left Bloc podcast, The Week at Work, which was talking about these sort of perceptions. And we've seen things. I mean, it's just interesting to see somebody like Lisa McGee, the writer of Derry Girls, you know, sort of said that some people didn't regard her as sufficiently Irish. You know, there's been a few other controversies recently about this as well. So, you know, there is a getting to know each other that needs to take place. And I'm part of that as well. You know, I'm partly because of my own kind of background. I always kind of, my own cultural imagination has always lay elsewhere. You know, I'm kind of formed in relation to...
Well, your cultural references are very similar to mine in terms of 1970s British TV, BBC One, BBC Two, ITV, because we've had these conversations before, because I grew up in London, you grew up in Belfast, but the cultural references are very British. They're very focused on that.
I mean, you support a London football team, so do I. Just that mine's better than yours, you know. But, you know, so,
and,
you know.
And I was born there. I just want to say I was born near Crystal Palace, so fuck off. But anyway, carry on.
Well, I was born in the east end of a city, so West Ham. But, you know, football team... Television, you know, all my favourite writers, Stan Barstow, mm-hmm. Alan Bleasdale, you know, the people I sort of grew up with, the pop music, you know, and even being 16 years old, the first thing I do is I write to the British Labour Party and ask them if I can become a member. Yeah. And of course, they write back and they say, no, you're not eligible to be a member, but you can make a donation. And here's a poster of Neil Kinnock, which I dutifully put on my wall. So, you know.
You just admitted that publicly to thousands of podcast listeners, by the way. Yeah, you had a picture of Neil Kinnock on your fucking wall.
I'm hoping that the podcast will run longer. I'll eventually be able to recover that at some stage.
I hope you replaced it with Shea Guevara and James Connolly soon after. Carry on.
But, you know, that's kind of where I'm kind of formed. Yeah. So, You know, and again, part of this, again, it's part of, you know, everybody, I don't think anybody ever is fully politically formed. You're always kind of in progress. And one of the things in my, you know, I'm now 55 years old. I can't even claim now to be middle-aged unless I tend to live until I'm 110. So, you know, one of the things I've kind of realised is, you know, I find myself sometimes standing in my hometown, you know, in the mizzle and the rain coming down. I think, Jesus, I'm going to live and die in this miserable little fucking hole. And I am, you know. And so in some way, I've got to find a way to reconcile myself and come to know myself as somebody who belongs here. And I think that's one of the things I'm interested in also. You know, I think there's an awful lot of people in the North who make this kind of assertion that this place belongs to them, mm-hmm. this kind of sense of ownership. And I don't really feel that any longer. I kind of look at it and sort of think, well, I kind of belong to this place. Yeah. This is where I belong to. And that's not, so I can't define it forever. You know, I'd sort of come and go and, you know, I'm just one of a wave of people who's turned up at some stage and lived here and moved on. And so it's a chance to think about that. It's a chance to sort of think about the kind of legacy that we want to leave for subsequent yeah. generations. Because you, as you say, you can't own a place. Not really. You know.
Well, no, you always, whenever people refer to like our economy, I'm like, I'm sorry, but it's not your economy. It belongs to another class of people entirely. Mm-hmm. At the weekend, we've just returned, for those who don't know, from a great political festival on the island of Inishere in Galway called Scoil Cuisclí. Steve spoke at it last year, and we went back this year with a larger group of people. There was a really interesting presentation by Sean Fearon, I thought was really interesting. It was entitled, "There's No United Ireland on a Dead Planet." And the whole debate around constitutional change, demographic change, about building new islands and relationships, and even the very focus mm-hmm. of your new podcast is that looming behind that, like a tidal wave, is climate change and is, you know, civilizational breakdown before the end of the century. Things that are being predicted not by me or you, but by the United Nations, by the ICCPR. Things. So does that feature, do you think, should that feature in our debates around New Ireland, that, you know, we're running out of time to save our planet and our yeah. societies, let alone this little bit of it here on this tiny little island in the Atlantic?
I mean, it should. Again, this is one of the things I'm interested in, because I'm no real expert in this, in the field of environmental science. And I tend to rely upon other people. I like some mm-hmm. people like John Barry to kind of give me a steer on these things. But what I do think is that at the moment, we don't have the kind of political forums or cultural or media forums to actually begin to address that problem in a satisfactory way, mm-hmm. which brings me back to that point I made earlier on. You know, unless you have a kind of constitutional settlement that is sufficiently democratic that you can begin to properly address those problems, they are just going to come at you like a tidal wave. Mm-hmm. And at the moment, I mean, it's like, how long have we known about this? Yeah. How long have we been sitting? I remember John Craven's News Round reporting on climate change.
Another British cultural reference there. Yeah. I also remember John Craven's News Round. Carry on.
So, you know, I remember what. So we've known this for an awful long time. Our inertia in the face of that has been incredible. You know, and what counts for that inertia for me, it has to be the political systems within which we live mm-hmm. and the kind of media and communicative environments that we have to serve those political systems. So we need to think about those things.
Yeah.
You know, and another thing too is, you know, thinking about constitutions isn't parochial. You know, it's not a parochial thing to sort of think about the constitution of this island, what it might look like. It's about trying to find that voice that we lack at the moment. As I said, I've never elected a government that's governed me, as most people here presume haven't either. If you don't have your own voice, how are you ever going to talk to your neighbours about what we do about that tsunami that's coming towards us? And it's just that voicelessness that needs to be addressed.
Yeah, there's a nuance to that conversation that's needed that doesn't really exist anywhere. As you said, there's no forum for it. Someone asked me once about trademarks work particularly, because we've been involved, as you know, in the community relations game and peace and reconciliation work for almost 30 years, coming on 30 years, and I've been involved in it since 1997 directly. And people said, you must have loads of experience in having these debates. And when I think back, we've delivered thousands of training sessions. I've delivered hundreds of residential courses with people, but our work was very truncated. It's very clear. Our work was normally firefighting and into a workplace where there was a sectarian incident or threats or harassment or intimidation of workers. And so we didn't really get into that debate. You got into a debate of don't do that, behave yourself, knock on the head, get back to work. Mm. And the odd time you had a debate about identity and how things work, but it wasn't the kind of debate we have to have about how this place moves forward and what we're going to create out of that, you know. So, and I'm not sure there are that many people who have had that debate, because most of the community relations spaces or places where people talk about these things are quite, well, they're quite policed, you know. You have to have the debate within certain parameters. You're not allowed to talk about new things. And for Protestants, and in my experience of people from a Protestant background, and particularly in the trade union, which is full of tens of thousands of Protestants and people with British identities and unionists within the Labour movement. But for those who begin to really, as I would see it, question fundamentally the makeup of the state and of capital and of the world economy, they begin to go on a journey. And the danger there is, I've seen so many times, this is the question I wanted to ask you, is that people go on a political journey, an ideological journey, but it often means going on a physical journey, because there's an awful lot of people who've gone on that, who've been forced to leave the places where they live because they cannot have that debate or even that political identity in the place they're living. Is that true or not, do you think?
I'm sure it is. Yeah, I mean, the island's full of people who migrated for one reason or another, sort of forced out, and very often those will be sort of political reasons. I mean, we've seen the sort of migration of people from one end of Belfast to the other and stuff like that. I mean, that's always the case. I mean, that's one of the problems is if you don't have the facility to ask questions, to inquire, to put forward new perspectives and new ideas because you're frightened or because the debate is being so closely policed that you don't feel you're able to, you know, that's not democratic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we can sort of see we're at a stage at the moment where either we have a democratic response to the crisis that we find ourselves in, or the alternative looks pretty awful, you know, and democracy, to my mind, has always got to be the best option for working class people, for the working class movement. Democracy has to be the way forward, because those are precisely the voices that won't be heard. Those are precisely the people who otherwise get bullied out of the debate. So, you know, you've got to have a much more free and open exchange about these things, because that's where the new thinking's going to come from. That's where the surprising ideas will come from.
Is that new thinking coming from as well? There was an analysis that I suppose we used to articulate quite a lot, was that the concept of, you know, big house unionism or cross-class unity within unionism was one of the foundational building blocks of this state, is that the Protestant section of the working class and big house unionism were part of that same ethno-nationalist identity. This was their state. This is how they were going to run it. That's beginning to break apart, that's fracturing all over the place. And that unity of unionism, if you like, is not gone yet, but it's on its way out.
There was a thing I wrote a blog post around the time of the flag protests. And I got picked up by a well-known local journalist. I was writing this wee blog that nobody ever read. And this local journalist picked up on it, and I got an awful slagging for it. And the thing that I sort of said was that this was the flag protests were a moment either both of opportunity and danger, in a sense. They were, you know, it was very, very clear that there was, you know, an awful lot of discontent in working class communities, and that needed to be addressed in some way. But it would be best addressed if, you know, working class unionists had an opportunity to talk to themselves and to decide on a sort of strategy. So they had to do that. But the other thing, the danger I thought was, and this is like 2011, isn't it? I think the flag protests, you know, this is the start of austerity. I sort of said that this would also be an occasion when this would be a bad time for working class people perhaps to find themselves alienated from the good opinion of their middle class neighbours. Now, to be honest, I think working class people are always alienated from the good opinion of their middle class neighbours. But you could see there in the flag protests a kind of fracture opening up between working class Protestants and, you know, co-religionists who perhaps have been different organisations that they would have been sort of colleagues within. Mm-hmm. That's changing, that's shifting.
Yeah.
You know, there's a middle class in the north now, which is, you know, what it wants is its delightful consumer lifestyle and identity that comes from that. And it has the income to go and enjoy that. And it sort of looks now at working class Protestants as a bit of a shackle around their ankle. Now, you know, I think working class Protestants have in that context have got to start thinking, you know, what do we need now? What are we? How are we going to orientate ourselves in this kind of new environment? Where, you know, and let's be honest about it, there's always been a degree of suspicion in working class Protestant areas about the middle class. You know, when I was a working class Protestant boy, we were suspicious of them. So that hasn't really changed. But I think what's happened at the moment, that gap's opening up an awful lot more. And that's a space where there needs to be a bit of a debate and a conversation about the way forward.
Yeah, and so to, I suppose that's those are the kind of voices you're going to try and get onto the podcast as well, some working class voices that need to be heard, because their voices are noticed while they're absent from nearly everything.
Yeah.
You just don't hear that voice at all. You don't hear those points of view. I was going to finish off with a question I wanted to ask you as well about. It's a bit of a curveball question, but it's important to me and to you because we're both part of it, and that's the Labour movement, that's the trade union movement. The trade union movement in the North has always commended itself for surviving the Troubles, for not splitting along ethno-nationalist lines. There was no Ulster TUC that emerged, although it was tried on a number of occasions. And that although you might belong to a British union and I belong to a British Union Unite, they're organised through the Irish Congress of Trade Unions, which kind of reflected the Good Friday Agreement long before the Good Friday Agreement came about, which is the idea of East-West relations as long as North-South, and as trade unions we recognise that. But the trade union in the six counties particularly, but also in Ireland, it's probably one of the most partitionist organisations on the island, actually. And it doesn't talk about the constitutional question. Is the trade union movement that we both belong to and we're both active in, does it not have a role to step up to the plate a bit and start encouraging its members who are drawn from every community here? You know, do we not have a responsibility and the leadership or the membership to put pressure on the leadership to start to begin to have that debate about the new constitutional arrangements on this island?
I think they do, and I hope they do. And one of the reasons for that is because, you know, the trade unions are probably one of the few democratic organisations capable of doing that. I mean, again, it takes me back to a point I made earlier on. You know, we all live here in a state of democratic deficit. Mm-hmm. The only, even in my workplace, one of the reasons why, no matter how frustrated I sometimes can be as a trade union member, and anybody who's a trade union member and isn't frustrated, you know, should check their pulse.
Isn't a trade union.
You know, but they are democratic, you know, and they're democratic organisations, and we probably need more of them. And so as a democratic organisation through which people can find a voice, we desperately need them to sort of find it now and not let this debate, be carried on by those people who would otherwise, as I say, leave you on the cutting room floor and just regard you as persuadables. Find something to say, make a contribution at this stage, because this is the moment. It's in the moment when you're in sort of a constitutional transformation. That's not the moment to sit in your hands and go, well, we'll see how this works out and then we'll ask for things the other side of it. Do it now. Do it now, because the things that you ask for will be built into whatever kind of agreement or framework comes out the other side of it. And so I think that's kind of key. The trade unions have got to offer some leadership here.
Yeah, we'll finish on that point that Labour won't wait this time round.
Not this time.
Look, we're going to leave it there, Steve. Thanks so much for your contribution today on your own podcast. Well done for your first. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Watch out for North, the new podcast hosted by Steve Baker. It's going to appear on the Left Block platform of podcasts, which is available on leftblock.ie, along with Trademarks, The Worker's Guide to Everything, The Week at Work, an Irish language podcast, Null and Oak, and the ABCs of Green Politics. That's five solidly fucking excellent podcasts for you to avail of. Feel free as well to bung a few quid at the Patreon, which pays for the whole thing and keeps it going, and pays for political schools across the country. It pays for an annual political festival on an island somewhere off the island of Ireland. Thanks for listening, and Sláinte go fóill.